Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line 1, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. This week's guest is Anchorage pediatric gastroenterologist, Dr. I can't believe Greg Szymanczyk. I didn't have it on my notes and I spaced out there. I'm sorry, Greg. Our topic today is celiac disease, and we're also going to be discussing the cause of celiac disease, gluten, which has rather suddenly become everyone's worst enemy, is what I've been saying, and linked to all kinds of symptoms. We'll try to ferret out what's real and what's myth about gluten. To reach us during the next hour with your questions and comments, you can reach us locally at 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752, and our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Dr. Szymanczyk received all of his training through the military, and then after exiting the military in 2010, came on as a pediatric gastroenterologist at Providence Hospital and has recently gone into private practice here in Anchorage. A link to his website is at alaskapublic.org, the Line 1 connection. Greg, it's great to have you here, and I'm sorry for the bizarre introduction.
Oh, that's okay. It's good to be here. Thank you.
So let's start with some definitions and tell us exactly what we mean by the term celiac disease. I think one of the things I'm hoping we can clarify today is that everything that happens with wheat or components of wheat and grains is not celiac disease. So let's get some definitions here. What's celiac disease?
So celiac disease is an abnormal inflammatory response to wheat and wheat-related proteins, specifically gluten and gliadins. And those proteins are commonly found in wheat, barley, oats, rye, so grains that are closely associated with the grain wheat. As I stated, it's an inflammatory reaction, so in that sense, it's similar to wheat allergy, and that wheat allergy is also an inflammatory response, but the inflammation is different than that of wheat allergy. So as you correctly stated, celiac disease is separate and distinct from wheat allergy, and I know we'll get into that.
Yeah. When I talk to patients about inflammation, I use an example commonly because I talk about allergy a lot, is that it's a little bit like what happens when you fall down and scrape your arm. Your body responds to that injury, and the inflammation is the body's response to that. And there's a number of mechanisms whereby inflammation occurs. Infection causes inflammation. Injury, like a broken bone, causes some inflammation. And I think of celiac disease as an autoimmune inflammation as opposed to allergic inflammation, as you've already implied, is different. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that's fair.
So autoimmunity is different in what way? How does that cause inflammation?
So autoimmunity is different in that the inflammation is coming from within. I mean, certainly there's a trigger, but basically what happens is the immune system is stimulated, probably in an appropriate fashion many times, but the inflammatory system can't shut itself off appropriately. So inflammation is properly triggered, and then it takes on a life of its own, and that continued ongoing inflammation begins to damage self rather than what the inflammatory response is supposed to do, which is protect self from foreign things that are damaging or potentially harmful.
Mm-hmm. So other examples of inflammatory disease are some kinds of thyroid disease, some kinds of arthritis. Type 1 diabetes is an inflammatory disorder where our own immune system is attacking the cells that make insulin. Rheumatic fever. So those are all distinct problems as opposed to allergy where the mechanism is different. We detect the mechanism by skin testing often and sometimes patch testing, whereas this is a different form. And the immune system's attacking our own cells, turned on by some factor, in this case probably gluten or components of gluten.
Right, right. So the proteins in wheat and grains closely related to wheat are recognized by certain cells that line the gut and present those proteins to the immune system, and then there's an abnormal inflammatory response that our immune system has to that presentation of those proteins.
How common is true celiac disease?
It's stated that it can be as common as 1 in 200. I've seen that in a number of studies. And when you look at those studies and you look at the data that those studies derive those numbers from, it bears that out. That being said, I'm not sure that I see it as often as that. So I think in my mind, it's questionable exactly what the right number is, but I have seen it as high as 1 in 200 people.
That seems similar to my experience. Everybody wants nowadays, as I've said, they're worried about wheat causing problems. And so I'm doing a lot more screening tests, which we'll get into in a minute, about celiac disease. And I don't find it very often. I don't know what other pediatricians' experience is. And yet the screening test is supposedly pretty helpful now, particularly if it's positive.
Right. And in my experience, in addition to the screening test, oftentimes I'm doing endoscopies and biopsies on patients, not specifically because of positive celiac disease tests, but because of other presenting signs and symptoms, and we end up doing a scope on somebody, and we end up doing a biopsy that would look for celiac disease if it were there. And even in those cases, I don't seem to find it as often as the incidence is stated in the literature.
Yeah.
Now, that being said, you look at the studies that, you know, come up with those numbers, and some of those are studies where they take donor blood and they take samples from certain number of units of blood that have been donated and run celiac testing on those. And, you know, so there's some selection of those patients. It's not everybody donates blood, so mm-hmm.
Yeah, so some of the testing, so you get into what we call selection bias. Not everybody, it's just everybody that walks into a doctor's office for a physical examination, for example. It may be people who are coming in with intestinal problems or other disorders. We know celiac disease may happen more commonly in certain people, too.
Right.
Mm-hmm. What are the classic symptoms of true celiac disease?
Well, it's interesting because when I started in pediatric GI in 1995, we used to think of celiac disease as a gastrointestinal disorder that had some other features that were unique. And I think one of the things that has changed as far as the thinking of celiac disease over the recent years in my experience has been that now it's thought of more as a multi-system disease that typically has some classic GI features to it, but as I know we'll get into later, may or may not have GI features. So to answer answering your question a little circuitously, but I think what you want from me is what are the classic GI symptoms,
right,
of celiac disease. And so typically those are chronic or recurrent diarrhea. Patients can have malabsorption. One of the very characteristic things is that patients appear to be bloated. So particularly children sort of have a pot belly look. They can have iron deficiency anemia is a common feature. And in children particularly, those children tend to be shorter than other children the same age and sex. So they have some nutritional stunting related to that. They can also have dental abnormalities. And so those are probably the biggest classic features.
And those are
failure to thrive too,
yeah,
for children.
Those are, yeah. So when I came out of training 30 years ago, I would think of it as fat malabsorption, failure to thrive kinds of kids. And yet it may be that there are much, much milder forms or a much more bell-shaped curve of people that are affected by celiac disease. Is that fair to say?
Oh, yeah, very certainly. There's, I've heard a number of cases presenting as just isolated fat-soluble vitamin deficiency, so maybe bone disease due to vitamin D deficiency, yeah, night blindness due to vitamin A deficiency, blood disorders due to vitamin E deficiency, things like that.
So what is the autoimmune disease is to some degree attacking the lining of the intestine. So let's take our listeners down into the intestine a little bit and say what happens to that small intestine and what are the results of that injury.
Right. So that's the unique thing is that even in those cases that we spoke about where people don't really have many GI symptoms or even any GI symptoms whatsoever, what's interesting is that there's still that characteristic inflammatory response in the gut. So even somebody who just has bone disease and maybe has an abnormal fracture from a trauma that shouldn't cause a fracture and doesn't have any reported GI symptoms, if we were to do their intestinal biopsy, we would still find evidence of that that abnormal inflammation in the gut. And the part of the gut that we're looking at is the first part of the small intestine. That's the area of the intestine that we can access from above with a typical scope. And usually we're looking at the first several inches of small intestine after the stomach. And the characteristic findings that we'll see in there, first of all, I should describe maybe what that would typically look like. And this is sort of a verbal cartoon I'm going to give to you. But basically, if you think of the small intestine, it's sort of like a shag carpet, very long, not really fibers, but you can think of them maybe as fibers or maybe like the sponges at the end of a car wash, very long structures that we call villi. And what those villi do are several things. One is they greatly increase the absorptive area or the absorptive surface of the small intestine. And they increase that contact surface, and along those villi are various enzymes that help us to digest foods and food components. As compared to PVC pipe, which is smooth and has very limited surface area. So what typically happens in celiac disease at that intestinal level is that the villi will typically be shortened or blunted so that they're not as long, which greatly overall decreases the absorptive area of the small intestine and decreases the amount of area available to present those enzymes for digestion of food. So you'll have malabsorption related to that. The other thing is that at the bases of those villi are some structures called crypts, and those are sort of pockets between the villi from which the cells that line the surface of the villi come from. So those crypts will be deepened and more pronounced in classic celiac disease inflammation. Mm-hmm. And then the third component is that in the area underneath the lining of the intestine in that region, there'll be some inflammatory cells called intraepithelial lymphocytes, which basically just means lymphocytes within the wall of the bowel there. And those inflammatory cells, lymphocytes, are a subset of white blood cells. Those lymphocytes will be increased in numbers, and they have a certain characteristics to them that people can identify that they're related to celiac disease. But those will be increased in number in that area.
So then, as a result of inflammation, as we've defined that as this autoimmune reaction to protein components of certain grains, the function of the small bowel and the structure of the small intestine are injured, leading to inability to digest certain foods, which then leads to a lot of the symptoms that you've talked about, the gas, sometimes the malabsorption of fat-soluble vitamins like A and D, and the consequences.
Right.
It used to be, and I guess we could say still is the gold standard, is that biopsy, especially before and after the removal of gluten from the diet, where we would see the repair. But now we can do blood tests that are much more attractive to patients, let's put it that way, that can screen for this disorder.
Right. Again, going back to when I started, still the classic way, which goes back to the original classic definitions of how do you determine what truly causes and is related to a disease process, not even just celiac disease. The original diagnosis required an initial biopsy to show the classic inflammatory pattern in the small bowel. Then it included starting the gluten-free diet, which I know we're going to get into, but starting the gluten-free diet and then observing for clinical resolution, meaning that the symptoms got better, and then doing that second biopsy to look at the lining of the intestine to make sure that the inflammation that had been there previously was now gone and resolved. And then even more so at that original time, that classic definition of that disease included reintroducing gluten into the diet and doing yet a third biopsy to show that that inflammation had in fact recurred again mm-hmm. with the reintroduction of gluten. Mm-hmm. As you pointed out, now we have these blood tests that are very specific and sensitive for looking for celiac disease. And typically, the consensus is still that we need to do that one biopsy to truly confirm that somebody has the disease. But if we have positive blood testing and characteristic symptoms, and we have a biopsy that's consistent with celiac disease, and then the patient improves their symptoms and resolves any abnormalities of blood tests and things like that on the gluten-free diet, then that's sufficient to make the diagnosis. I don't think we've quite gotten to the point yet where we as gastroenterologists feel that it's acceptable to just do the blood testing without the biopsy to make that diagnosis, although I know that there is a school of thought among some people that may be sufficient.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind our listeners real quickly. My guest is Dr. Greg Szymanczyk. He is a pediatric gastroenterologist in Anchorage, and we're talking about celiac disease. I want to really define what we mean by that problem and how it's caused and what are the consequences, and then perhaps move on to other problems that may be related to wheat to help clarify this sudden concern about gluten in the diet and help people really understand what this what these problems are, what's real about these problems and what may be not so real. If you've got questions, our local number, 550-8433, our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. And if you haven't listened before, you know you have to spell out line one, L-I-N-E-O-N-E. A lot of these symptoms of bloating and gaseousness and vitamin deficiency, particularly iron deficiency anemia, are not very specific. And what I find is a lot of the times the public hears about a symptom, reads about a symptom, and then jumps to the conclusion that that symptom has to be related to, let's say, in this case, gluten, when in fact it sounds to me like, and what is often the case, these are very non-specific symptoms. And what I'm trying to say is that many these symptoms that you're describing, especially individually, are not very specific for celiac disease. They can occur in all kinds of different disorders. And so that makes it how physicians look at symptoms a little bit different than the public might.
Right. No, that's exactly true, that the symptoms are very nonspecific. And again, as we mentioned earlier, nowadays we recognize that celiac disease in some cases doesn't even have gastrointestinal symptoms. So truthfully, virtually any patient that comes in any office with or without GI symptoms, just on the basis of that alone, could have celiac disease. So you have to look at who's likely to have celiac disease, what other types of features they might have that they're presenting with. And, you know, that's really where the doctor and their expertise comes in as to who should be screened and who shouldn't be. And then even further, among the patients who, you know, we decide should be screened, what's the most cost-effective way to screen them? Because certainly there are antibody mm-hmm. panels out there and blood tests out there that cost $500 a pop. And, you know, we can't, it wouldn't be reasonable to screen everybody with one of those panels.
Well, let's talk about the screening tests themselves, I guess, first. The other thing I don't want to forget to talk about is understanding exactly why it's important to define these illnesses or that we may talk about today specifically, because they may have, in fact, they often do have different natural histories. There's celiac disease untreated. It may end up with a lot different consequences than somebody who's just has a little intolerance to wheat that we may describe. So it's not just a matter of semantics when we talk about these things.
Correct.
All right, let me make sure I don't forget this question. Then before we come back to the blood test in specific, what do we know about the natural history of untreated celiac disease? Unrecognized, you know, somebody's got celiac disease, continues to eat gluten. What can we say about the natural history of those people?
Well, what we do know is that the people who have untreated celiac disease will frequently go on to have a whole host of other autoimmune conditions, and those autoimmune conditions occur in a much higher frequency in somebody who has celiac disease that's untreated. It's hard to do what we call longitudinal studies to prove that, where you take somebody and follow them for 70 or 80 years of their life and treat some and don't treat some. So where that data comes from is what we call cross-sectional studies, where we take a look at people across different age groups, maybe people in their teens, 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s, and we compare them to patients who have celiac disease in each of those age groups and look back at when those patients were diagnosed, when those patients were identified, when their symptoms likely started, perhaps how long they had disease before they were treated, and how long they went untreated before being on a gluten-free diet. And then they look at the incidence of autoimmune diseases in those various populations. And those studies would suggest that people who have had celiac disease symptoms for a longer period of time before they went before they began a gluten-free diet and were adequately treated, that those patients have an increased incidence of other autoimmune diseases, commonly diabetes, autoimmune thyroid disease, things like that occur in much higher frequency in patients who have had celiac disease symptoms for a long period of time before being adequately diagnosed and treated. The other thing that we know is that patients with celiac disease over the course of their lifetime are at an increased risk of a particular type of bowel cancer called lymphoma, and that lymphoma typically involves the small intestine, and those patients are at increased risk of that as well.
Mm-hmm. So one reason to be sure of a diagnosis is to understand the consequences, and the food allergy consequences may be different than somebody who has a non-celiac sensitivity, which we'll define here in a little bit, versus celiac disease. So there is a real reason to try to be precise about the diagnosis if you're having trouble with wheat.
Right. Yeah, with celiac disease, I mean, one of the things I skipped over was obviously the nutritional consequences. If you're having malabsorption of various substances in the diet, and you know, fat-soluble vitamins, iron, things like that. So, and just calories in general and fats. So, if you're malabsorbing those substances, obviously your nutrition and your growth suffers. So those need to be corrected as well. But as you point out, you might quite truthfully have symptoms from wheat without having celiac disease, but have no nutritional consequences or other medical consequences other than that you feel lousy.
Mm-hmm. So let's go back to these screening tests, which have made life a little bit easier in screening, but also led perhaps to some of the reason that we may be feeling that there's much more celiac disease than there is. And that's one of the questions we will eventually address here, is whether that's really increasing. But what are the blood tests that we do to help us understand whether or not a patient may have true celiac disease?
So the blood tests that we do, first of all, it's a bunch of medical jargon, so it could be confusing because they're not words that people are going to be familiar with hearing. But the initial blood tests that came out looking at celiac disease were anti-gliadin antibodies, and gliadin comes from gluten, and so it looked at different antibodies against the gliadin. That was a reasonable test. It's a very sensitive test, meaning that generally if people have celiac disease, that test will be positive. But it's not a very specific test, meaning that anytime it's positive, a nice test that's very specific would generally suggest that if somebody has that test being positive, that's the disease that they have. And with celiac disease, the anti-gliadin testing is very sensitive, so people frequently aren't missed by that test. But just having that positive test doesn't mean that they have celiac disease. A number of other disease states can cause that to be elevated. And in some cases, if you look at patients who don't have any GI symptoms and don't have celiac disease, they can have positive blood tests, and we don't really understand with the anti-gliadins why that is. So then more specific tests were developed. And some of the more specific tests that we have had since then are things like the anti-reticulin antibodies, the anti-endomesial antibodies, the anti-tissue transglutaminase antibodies, and now more recently sort of a next generation of the anti-gliadin, which is a anti-deaminated gliadin antibody. So typically what's used more frequently now are the anti-tissue transglutaminase antibodies, and sometimes, especially for younger patients, particularly under the age of 2, anti-deaminated gliadin antibodies, as those blood tests tend to be much more specific for celiac disease when they're positive and are still very, very sensitive.
So just to help listeners understand this again, I'm going to try to make this maybe a little bit clearer. What the immune system does is it makes, one thing it does is it makes antibody. It makes self-human proteins against foreign proteins, or sometimes our own proteins in the case of an autoimmune disorder. And what Dr. Szymanczyk is saying is that we're now able to measure lots and lots of different antibodies. Some are more specific and sensitive, and that's what we're looking for. And currently this IgA-TTG antibody is the one that's often used or felt to be the best screening.
Yeah, that's a very, very good screening test. So the IgA anti-TTG is how we refer to it, but It's that anti-tissue transglutaminase. And what's important to understand about that is that that's an immunoglobulin A test. So when you talk about those antibodies that our bodies make to protect ourselves from foreign proteins, we make a number of different forms of antibodies we make, and they're called immunoglobulins or antibodies, and we make them in different forms. We have immunoglobulin A, E, G, D. So, and we have a number of different antibodies that we make, and the immunoglobulin A type of the tissue transglutaminase is an excellent screening test. Where it falls down a little bit, however, is that there are some patients who overall don't make enough immunoglobulin A or antibody A against anything. So those patients have low immunoglobulin A tests at baseline no matter what you direct it towards. And if you were to just measure anti-tissue transglutaminase IgA in those patients, it would be low, but falsely low because they're immunoglobulin A deficient. So generally we recommend that when you use that screening test for celiac disease that you do a total serum IgA as well to make sure that the patient doesn't have that problem. And if they do, you just can order an anti-tissue transglutaminase IgG, an immunoglobulin G form of the same or of the similar antibody.
And if that IgA test is positive, then it is not 100% certain that that patient has celiac disease, is what I've heard you say.
That's correct. There can be false positives, although it's a small number, there can be false positives to that test as well. And that's why the biopsy is important.
It's another reason for not screening large groups of people who are asymptomatic, is you get more people that are going to have false positives than really got the disease with some of these screening tests.
And correct.
Yeah, that's what gets people into trouble.
Right, then you
end up doing stuff to people that never needed to be done.
Then you start chasing a test for asymptomatic patients.
Yep. All right, it is now time for us to take a break. I know we have a couple of emails that are addressing this issue of the confusion between other issues related to wheat, and we will get to those emails. But I want to let everyone know, again, you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. Our local number is 550-8433. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll continue our conversation about celiac disease and gluten with Dr. Greg Szymanczyk. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection on KSKA Anchorage. If you missed part of today's program or would like to listen again to Line 1, Your Health Connection, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. You can subscribe to free podcasts of Line 1, Your Health Connection on our website at alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest is pediatric gastroenterologist Greg Szymancyk, and we're discussing dietary gluten and its relationship to illness, both real and sometimes imagined. You can email your questions to us at line1@alaskapublic.org. We'll be here until just before 2 o'clock, or 3 o'clock, 3 o'clock, I guess it is. Our local number is 550-8433. You can reach us during the next 30 minutes at that number. And we also can be reached through a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. But please remember, if you're listening on Monday evening between 7 and 8, you're listening to a rebroadcast, and we will not be able to address your questions at that particular time. All right, so one other question that comes to mind about the screening test is, do you have to be ingesting gluten at the time you do the screening test? How important is that factor in that screening test?
That's extremely important, actually. What you'll find, and we talked about this or alluded to this earlier when we talked about the biopsy and the old way of diagnosing things where we treated somebody and then repeated their biopsy, is not only does their biopsy improve and normalize, but their antibodies should become negative as well. So if you do these antibody tests as screening tests and then you put somebody on a gluten-free diet, what you should see is that their antibody levels come down and eventually normalize on a gluten-free diet. So if someone were to have symptoms that were suggestive of celiac disease and they themselves or their provider were to put them on a gluten-free diet without doing the workup or making the diagnosis for celiac disease, they may very well feel better, but by the time they come in for that diagnosis, their antibody screening test may be negative and their biopsies may be negative. So it becomes very difficult at that point to be able to tell somebody whether they have celiac disease definitively or not, or even whether they're likely to have had celiac disease or not. So it does become very difficult because, as we're about to talk about shortly, I'm sure, is what's the treatment? And if you have celiac disease, it's a lifelong treatment. And if you have some of the other wheat-related or gluten-related issues that we spoke about, it may not be forever. So that's the importance of making that diagnosis.
So I guess I want to make sure the public is hearing also is doctors can mess up too. We may not remember to ask you, are you eating gluten when we're taking these tests? And so there can be false negatives. People that really have gluten or celiac disease and have a negative test, and we would miss them. So things have to be done right. They have to be done correctly. We have to do the right antibody screens, and we oftentimes need a biopsy to be absolutely sure because this is a nasty illness, it sounds like.
Yes. I mean, the real thing is that the diet is very restrictive, and so it's a potentially unpleasant diet to follow for the rest of one's life if one doesn't need to.
And so let's talk about treatment. And what you've already implied is if you got celiac disease, as far as we know, the rest of your life, you got to be on this diet.
Right. And so you need to be on a gluten-free diet for the rest of your life. And that is a diet that's free from wheat, barley, rye, and oats. So all four of those grains have to be taken out of the diet and need to be permanently taken out of the diet. So you can continue to eat other grains like corn and rice, but the vast majority of the grains that are commonly found in our foods then have to be removed from the diet. And sometimes people are very, very sensitive to even minuscule amounts of those grains, depending on how bad their level of autoimmunity related to their celiac disease is. Mm-hmm.
This is a question that just popped into my mind, and because of food allergies, I'm aware that a lot of times preparation of foods can lead to lack of symptoms. People who are allergic to peanuts, for example, may be able to tolerate peanut oils, certainly cooked peanut oils, not cold pressed peanut oil, which the heating process of making the oils causes the proteins to denature or change and shape, and then the body doesn't recognize them. Are you aware of, does food preparation have any effect on celiac disease? I hadn't ever thought of that question or even read anything.
Yes and no. It it doesn't substantially change the proteins enough that you're not going to react to them. So no matter how it's prepared or cooked. Now, that being said, the way that it can be a factor is that particularly in manufactured items, you'll sometimes look at a package label and it doesn't have anything on there that would suggest that there's any wheat or gluten-related proteins in there, but they won't label it as gluten-free and you'll wonder why. And that may be because that product is manufactured on that same assembly line on Thursdays and Fridays, and Monday through Wednesday, they do produce a product on that line that does have wheat in there, so there can be some cross-contamination. So it is actually very important when you're looking at what foods you can eat that not only do you look at the ingredients to make sure that it doesn't have one of those four grains in there, but really that it's certified as a gluten-free product, that there is no potential for cross-contamination. I know in homes where I have patients that have celiac disease, they oftentimes have a separate toaster for the gluten-free bread item that their child uses. So it can be that specific.
Okay. All right. So I'm going to move into other issues that may be confused for or lead people to think they have wheat problems when they may not. I'm going to do that by using an email that came in. It says, some friends were talking the other day about how it seems like there is much more problem these days than there used to be with gluten, and speculating that why this might be. For example, one question, is there any connection between wheat problems and the increased use of genetically modified wheat?
As far as I'm aware, there isn't. We genetically modify our foods in a more formally scientific way now, but, you know, looking back since the beginning of agriculture, we've always genetically modified foods. We've always selected out the best crops, the best, you know, whether it was animals or livestock or agriculture, we always selected out the best and we made sure that those genes perpetuated. We looked for things that were insect resistant, drought resistant, and we saved those seeds and made sure that those were the best ones and that those were what got planted the next year. And we've done that in a more scientifically rigorous fashion now, but to my knowledge, there's not been any identifiable link with any genetically modified grains as far as increasing the risk of celiac disease or other wheat-related problems.
Okay. All right. So the answer to the question is that it's reasonable to assume that as we do things to wheat, which actually have been done by nature for millions of years or hundreds of thousands of years, that we might cause a problem. But to date, we're not aware of any problems related to that.
I think that's fair to say, yeah.
Okay. So another question, the same email, is it a myth that there's more gluten-related problems now than there was a generation or two ago?
Probably not. That's probably accurate. And what we have seen when we look at autoimmune diseases overall is that we have seen more autoimmunity in our population, at least in the United States, and probably in Europe and other parts of the world as well. Than we used to see. And again, that may go back to that a similar discussion as we just talked about in terms of genetically modifying food. As we become better at physicians and as better patients at seeking medical care and having access to medical care, we probably have perpetuated conditions in our population that previously people didn't live long enough to pass on those genes. And there's probably other factors as well, but we definitely have seen autoimmunity increasing, so I think it's not unreasonable to state that the incidence of celiac disease has gone up.
Okay, and so and I think it's fair to say we're reasonably certain that allergic disease as well as autoimmune disease, which are different, I want to keep coming back to that, is also increasing, particularly in Western societies. So the question then, the last question of this email is what else might be causing the increase? You mentioned one particular reason. We're better at making the diagnosis and more suspicious, but we also have misdiagnoses a lot. People
think
they've got gluten problems, which make up other ways wheat may cause problems.
Right. Yeah. I think there is a whole population of self-diagnosed or misdiagnosed patients who think or believe they have celiac disease who may very well not. And that's certainly a hard number to get a handle on what that represents. And it may relate to access to certain grains and things like that. For instance, there may be people in certain populations that were more segregated in the past, and now with increasing mobility in the 21st century and people moving and mixing of ethnicities and cultures, that people may be eating things that culturally they didn't used to eat.
There is a strong genetic predisposition to celiac disease, as I understand it, though.
Yes.
We have not mentioned that. You want to discuss that or mention it a little bit?
Yeah, there are some genes that are identified that have been well associated with celiac disease, so much so that, you know, if you have the absence of those genes, you're very unlikely to have celiac disease or to ever develop celiac disease. Unfortunately, testing for those genes can be fairly expensive. So again, as we mentioned before, just like you wouldn't do serologic testing on a whole huge population of people, most of whom are asymptomatic or without symptoms at all, you wouldn't recommend gene testing for that same population as well. Again, because of the expense and the low likelihood that those people would be positive. The other thing that does confound that is, while it's helpful if somebody has a gene test that looks at those genes and they don't have them, that they can identify that they likely don't have celiac disease, unfortunately, about 30% to 40% of the patient of the population walking around does have one of those genes, and very likely, you know, most of those people will never have celiac disease and aren't at risk for it. So there is a downside to that gene testing, which is, again, 30 to 40% of the time you might have one of those genes. And it also, in that case, doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to ever have celiac disease, nor that you have it now.
Those genes we're talking about just happen to be very important in how our individual immune systems process foreign proteins and trigger our immune system.
Right.
Okay. Steve, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. My mother was diagnosed at the University of Minnesota in the early 1970s with celiac disease, and she ended up with the cancer in her lower intestine in 1973, and she had a successful surgery and made a full recovery, stopped eating gluten, and she's healthy as a horse today, ready to turn 88. And I know I don't have celiac disease, but, you know, just listening to the program, I started wondering about my daughter. And you've already mentioned that there's a, you know, pretty strong correlation, you know, genetically. And, you know, I was wondering about some of the other symptoms other than the gut symptoms of celiac. Like, for instance, I remember my mother had a lot of complexion problems before celiac was diagnosed and before she stopped eating gluten. And my daughter just had, you know, she just has continuous complexion problems. Is that anything to worry about?
Well, there is a particular rash that's associated with celiac disease called dermatitis herpetiformis, but that's likely not, I mean, that's not a common complexion issue. So generally that's usually very itchy pimples and blisters on the extremities or things like that. And that's usually well recognized by physicians as being something atypical beyond the normal complexion issues. Other complexion issues may be related to celiac disease in the sense of, you know, nutritional deficiencies or maybe other vitamin deficiencies. But in general, complexion problems are very common among children and are common among adults. And just as we spoke about before, that may be a fairly nonspecific symptom that doesn't necessarily indicate celiac disease. That being said, if there's celiac disease in the family, usually we recommend screening of first-degree family relatives. So if your mother were to have celiac disease, now the recommendation would be that, children would be screened as well. And that might identify certain risk factors in terms of, what would be found on those screening tests. But if you don't have celiac disease, and then your daughter shouldn't be at any more likelihood of having celiac disease than anybody else in the population, even with your mother's diagnosis.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. We have another email that asks the same question about screening, so I'm just going to read some information I have just so we make sure that they hear that. And Dr. Szymanczyk, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but certainly the high-risk groups for celiac disease are first-degree relatives of patients with celiac disease, those with other autoimmune problems like thyroid problems, diabetes, and even some autoimmune hepatitis, but then Down syndrome, Turner syndrome, Williams syndrome are disorders, genetic disorders that seem to have a higher risk, and that's the information I have about the high-risk groups that should be screened. Does that fit with your information?
Yeah, the other group would be IgA deficient.
And IgA deficient, okay. Yep, okay. All right. So for people who have questions about that, hopefully that answers that question. Before we're getting moving pretty quick, and I want to make sure we talk about other ways wheat can cause gastrointestinal illnesses besides celiac disease.
So there's really two large categories where wheat can also be a problem in addition to celiac disease, and probably actually those categories probably encompass a number of patients that's larger than the number of patients who have celiac disease. So wheat allergy is another way that you can have gastrointestinal symptoms related to wheat. And again, as we spoke about at the very beginning of the program, it's a different type of inflammatory reaction than that of celiac disease. The other thing that's different is your allergy is specifically to wheat. So you may not have an allergy to barley, rye, or oats, so you may only need to eliminate wheat from your diet. Secondly, the other thing that may be different about that is that many times, especially children that have a food allergy, will outgrow that food allergy as they get older, particularly if they have that food allergy as an infant or a toddler. 95 to 98% of those children are very likely to outgrow that allergy by their third birthday. So that may not be a permanent lifelong restriction if one has an allergy. And if there is a restriction, it may be more specifically just to wheat but not to other grains other than wheat. And then the other category that we've spoken about a little bit is gluten intolerance or wheat intolerance. And an intolerance is defined as something that definitely gives one gastrointestinal symptoms. It may give one gas, it may give one diarrhea, it may give one abdominal pain. But when it's looked at more critically with objective studies, lab studies, blood tests, biopsies, there's actually no inflammatory response related to that. So the one that we're all familiar with hearing about is lactose intolerance. And again, it's a similar type problem where in lactose intolerance, we can't tolerate the milk sugar, and we have problems with that, and we get symptoms of bloating and gas and diarrhea, but we don't have any inflammation or damage. So it makes us feel bad, but it doesn't actually cause any damage to our bodies. So in gluten intolerance can be the same thing. You can definitely have symptoms related to gluten, but not have any damage or inflammation whatsoever.
And then and in that situation, maybe whereas you said with wheat allergy, just avoiding wheat may be all you need to do. And with this wheat sensitivity, it may carry over to other grains, again, somewhat like celiac disease, in that they're not being absorbed correctly and lead to this bloating and diarrhea and so forth.
You certainly could have that with other grains. And again, with the intolerances, again, just like some people who are familiar with lactose intolerance, it may be a supply and demand phenomenon. You may be able to tolerate a certain amount of wheat protein if you're just gluten intolerant, mm-hmm. whereas if you have celiac disease or a wheat allergy, you really shouldn't have any.
Mm-hmm. All right. So I think it's reasonable to suspect that a large percentage of people who think they have wheat-related problems probably don't have celiac disease, best we can tell.
I would say that that's correct.
From just very good studies, but that doesn't mean a large percentage of people don't have trouble with wheat in various ways.
Correct.
All right. So if people decide that they must avoid wheat or grains, what's the downside, if any, of that?
There may not be much of a downside to that at all. We do know, however, that diets that are high in fiber and are good for us in terms of lowering blood pressure, minimizing risk of cardiac disease, insoluble fiber is good for colon health. So there's a lot of positive aspects to fiber and grains and things like that. But it doesn't have to be wheat fiber. It doesn't have to be wheat grain. That just happens to be one of the staple grains in the United States. So it's a commonly available grain in our population, in our culture, but it doesn't have to be that fiber. But we do know that, that there are some very good properties of having grains in the diet as well. So we can't dismiss that and throw everything out the window with the wheat.
Yeah, I've tried to say a number of times on this program as often as we can. There's risks of treatment, any treatment. There's risk of not treating. And although the consequences of holding wheat out of your diet when it is not a significant problem may not be great, it still has some risk that you need to take into mind, is what you're saying.
Potentially, yes.
And certainly, I guess one of the messages here is if people think they really have a problem with wheat, it does make some sense to get a precise diagnosis because the consequences of each of these problems differs. Several of the problems we've talked about related to wheat differ significantly, and particularly that celiac disease does have an increased risk of lymphoma of the intestinal tract.
Correct.
All right. What else do we need to make sure, anything else that we have not addressed that we need to make sure people understand about symptoms related to wheat or celiac disease? Anything come to mind?
No, I think that's really the last point you made is just my big take-home point is that While people may very well have a problem with wheat and wheat-related proteins, it's very, very important to determine specifically what that problem is and what the right treatment for that particular problem is so that people don't unduly restrict their diets far beyond what they need to restrict. When we talked about, the harm of restricting a diet excessively, if one were to think they had celiac disease and take wheat, oat, rye, and barley out of their diet for the rest of their life, they may be inadvertently nutritionally depriving themselves if they're not making up for the calories and the other nutritional benefits of those grains in their diet somewhere else, particularly if they don't have celiac disease. So I think it's important that people know exactly what it is that they have, that the terminology is clear, and that they're on the right treatment for the problem that they have.
One problem we haven't discussed that might be confused along the same way is a disorder called irritable bowel syndrome. If you wouldn't mind just perhaps talking about what are the symptoms of irritable bowel syndrome, what do we mean by that? And then if you don't mind, I recently learned about what's called the FODMAP diet, F-O-D-M-A-P, as a treatment for some people with irritable bowel and how, which does include some of the wheat products, again, that avoidance, and how that might get confused.
So irritable bowel syndrome is a syndrome of, basically, it's a syndrome defined by symptoms. So irritable bowel syndrome, by definition, does not have any inflammation as a component to it. Irritable bowel syndrome is associated with abdominal pain, and then some abnormal alteration of the stools, either diarrhea, constipation, or a stooling pattern that goes back and forth between diarrhea and constipation. And in patients with irritable bowel syndrome, having a bowel movement whether it's a constipated bowel movement or a diarrheal bowel movement, will at least in part relieve the symptoms of their abdominal pain. And so that's how that definition is made, is the absence of inflammation, the absence of any evidence of other gastrointestinal disease and symptoms that fit that pattern. So with irritable bowel syndrome, we know that certain patients are triggered by certain types of food, particularly the irritable bowel syndrome patients that have diarrhea oftentimes are triggered by certain foods. So they may be triggered by foods that are high in fiber, and that would include many of the foods that have, that may also be on the celiac diet in terms of foods that have wheat in them and wheat-related fiber. So that can sometimes trigger those symptoms. The FODMAP diet that you referred to is really a diet that has really a lot of carbohydrates that are malabsorbed, but some other things that are related to the carbohydrates as well. So what the FODMAP actually stands for is fermentable oligo, di, and monosaccharides and polyols. And so those are found in various different food products, and some of the common terms that we would recognize or that people would recognize at home that would be on that are anything that contains fructose or lactose. Some of the lesser known things would be things like the fructans, which would be the wheat, onion, garlic. And then a lot of the beans have a substance called galactans in them. And then the polyols are some of the sweeteners like the sorbitols, the mannitols, and things like that, xylitol. So those are basically poorly digested substances, and many of which will then escape the digestion and absorption in the small intestine where that all takes place. And when they get to the large intestine, the bacteria that live in the large intestine will feed on those substances and cause and ferment those substances. And then the products of that fermentation are acids, water, and gas. So that's how the symptoms of diarrhea can be generated by those. So if you limit those things in the diet, some of those people with irritable bowel syndrome will get improvement.
Mm-hmm. I recently had a teenage girl who was screened for, because of chronic diarrhea and probably has irritable bowel syndrome, screened for celiac disease was negative, but responded dramatically to this FODMAP diet, which is a little bit like keeping lactose out of somebody's diet who has lactose intolerance.
Right,
to dairy
right.
Product.
It's a diet that if those substances are in there, you'll feel terrible, but you won't have caused any injury to yourself.
Thanks very much. This is a lot to cover. Hopefully people can recognize the point here is that it's everything associated with wheat's not celiac disease. I appreciate your time.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you having me.
So my thanks to today's guest, Dr. Greg Szymanczyk. You can follow this conversation on KSKA and Facebook. And we'll return next week when we discuss the treatment and prevention of food-related anaphylaxis with Anchorage allergist Dr. Melinda Rathkoff. So why not join us next week at the same time? Pat Yak is our chief content officer at Alaska Public Media. Kristen Spack is our web editor and audio engineer for today. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.